across America. Live, this is Point of View. And now, Kirby Anderson.
Thank you for joining me today here on Point of View. It is our weekend edition around the round table. We have Penna Dexter and Debbie Georgiadis. Big news, of course, is John Boehner stepping down as Speaker of the House. We'll certainly get into that. This weekend is Life Change, so you're going to hear a little bit about that. Of course, the Pope has been in town, and that probably would cover the entire program, but we do have a few other topics in addition to that. Certainly a little more information about that young boy who actually took apart a clock and took it to school and what we've learned there. Some of the comments by, of course, a number of people about Islam, including Ben Carson, and then the reaction, to the reaction on that. I know we will not get it all in, Penna, but we'll do our best with our electronic shoehorn.
We will try. And I think, you know, I woke up to the news. Actually, I was already awake, but I saw the news about John Boehner. Actually, he's resigning from the Speaker and stepping down from Congress in October. And, you know, he was supposed to retire last year or the year before, and he stayed on. So, you know, put that into your thinking cap when you think about this. And, you know, some of me wonders, some people are saying, well, he sacrificed his career for the Congress and things like that. So that's another thing to kind of mull over and swirl around in our minds. But I do think that there will be a new governing coalition of the House. They've already floated some names of people who might be Speaker that we can talk about a little bit later in the program. And, you know, just are some of the conservative folks going to come in and take control of the Congress? I wonder if this resignation by Speaker Boehner is not a way, sort of planned by establishment Republicans to sort of appease the anti-establishment wing during this time of primaries in the Republicans and seeing these outsiders rising. Perhaps there's some thinking that if Boehner leaves, a problem is leaving. I don't buy that.
I don't either. But again, when I think it was Marco Rubio announced this at the Values Voters Summit, a cheer went up. And so we'll see how that was. And Kelly Shackelford actually spoke after Marco Rubio and just before Donald Trump. And so we'll probably get some information from him about how it turned out.
Well, Kelly will obviously have a lot of people watching him.
Yes, I would think so. And certainly, Penna, you are usually there, but here for other reasons, which we could explain later if people care. And Debbie, I'd love to also get your comments, because we have John Boehner stepping down immediately as Speaker of the House, giving up his House seat by the end of October. Again, that caught me off guard. Maybe it caught everybody else off guard, but I'm really surprised, and that's the first topic that obviously we need to talk about today.
Oh, we sure do, and it did catch me by off guard. Certainly, I think almost everyone in Congress. He has been there since 1991. He's been in Congress a long time. He's held leadership positions. I know Penna's point a moment ago, there is a lot of speculation that maybe the RNC or the GOP thinks, gee, just take, he's kind of a target. He, as well as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, are a target of the, by the conservatives. And so maybe, well, we get him out of the way and we take that away. But if that really is the thinking, I think it really misses the entire point of the conservative activism in America, not just the Tea Party, but just elected conservative Republicans, because it's Boehner and Representative Boehner and Senator McConnell may represent leadership, but it's really the problem the conservatives have been pointing to is not going to go away just because this leader did. If we don't have conservative action on many of the important items, the current one being the defunding of Planned Parenthood, the grassroots will not be appeased.
It's an interesting picture when you think about that very issue, Debbie, because you have Ted Cruz, who's speaking out now that over the fact that the Senate was not able to get enough votes to defund Planned Parenthood, basically. And the House is just going ahead with something that doesn't even consider Planned Parenthood. They see that as their reality, not willing to shut down the government. So that's the battle there. And you've got the hardcore conservatives who don't mind shutting down the government over the really the sanctity of human life.
You know, I would like, that's exactly how the media and really the establishment Republicans paint this picture, is that the bottom line goal, the most important goal, is not to shut down government. Instead of the bottom line goal, most important thing is not to fund Planned Parenthood's abortion factory anymore or the baby slicing factory anymore. It is really a commentary on the quality and depth of thinking of Representative Boehner and actually of many Republicans. The worst evil they can envision is shutting down the government. as an aside, why they agree it's their fault, not just saying, this is actually, we've done a budget and President Obama's willing to shut down the government because he wants to fund Planned Parenthood. We don't ever win that battle in the media, but there are so many battles over the last several years that the higher goal was seen as do not let government shut down. So we'll capitulate on executive amnesty. We'll capitulate on Obamacare. We won't push anything about the border. Issue after issue where the conservatives are saying, these are vital issues, please do something. But the worst evil that it seems like the elected Republican establishment sees is we can't shut down the government. It's a horrible commentary on their values.
Yes. Well, and again, you will receive shortly an email that we have sending out, actually giving you a chance to express your opinion about this, because we thought it might be good to tell your elected representative in the House of Representatives, number one, that you'd like a more conservative Speaker of the House, but more importantly, that you want them to stand strong even if the Senate does not. I mean, at the point I made in the email that's going out is if you cannot even think about forcing an issue over the trafficking of baby parts, what issue are you eventually going to draw a line in the sand and actually fight about?
You know, also this whole line that Republicans would be blamed for the shutting down of government, it really depends on how you articulate it and how you set the issue up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for instance, back in 2013, there was this attempt to defund Obamacare and through the same process that is taking place now, and parts of the government did shut down for about 16 days. And it wasn't the horror for the GOP that everyone warned. As a matter of fact, think how well the GOP did in 2014. So, you know, others are saying, well, it's not going to repeat itself. It will be different. But there are some things more important than keeping every single part of the government running throughout.
Yeah, Penn, I couldn't agree more. There are so many points to be made if we had a really fervent, passionate, articulate set of leaders at the head in Washington, the House, and the Senate. One of them being your very point that shutting down the government is a myth. We don't ever stop paying for vital services for anyone. We have some people in government staying home and not coming to work, but we still have all of our vital functions are still being paid and functioning. It's just not the catastrophe that we try to paint. And then the larger point, again, which you alluded to, is I don't like the word messaging because it sounds artificial and manipulative, but saying the truth, which is we're happy to fund women's health care in many ways, even this Planned Parenthood thing, the Republicans are saying we'll fund actual women's health care. We're just not going to fund the Planned Parenthood abortion mill and the Planned Parenthood baby slicing operation. And so we'll fund it. And if the money doesn't go, it's because President Obama is insisting on funding those evil things.
The government exists to sometimes do hard things, and it just seems to me like instead of posturing, they could do the hard work of prioritizing where we put our funds. And, you know, defunding Planned Parenthood, of course, is a no-brainer, but also figure out how you can fund things and move the government forward, let it perform its necessary functions, and, you know, make some of these hard choices. But everything has to be political. Everything has to be a show.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some positive alternatives. Certainly, we're talking about Planned Parenthood and the resignation by John Boehner. But when we come back, I want to talk about Life Chain. We have a video that you can watch as well, and we're going to have a chance to talk with Sharon Albertson and encourage you to stand up for life this weekend. All that coming up right after this.
This is Viewpoints with Kirby Anderson.
You know, we all benefit these days from the economies of free market that allow for the invention of entrepreneurs to be manufactured at a small cost so that we can all enjoy them. We may not understand some of the complex economic issues around us, but we can see their impact in the prices we pay for sophisticated technology. John Tamney gives some great examples in his book, Popular Economics, What the Rolling Stones, Downton Abbey, and LeBron James Can Teach You About Economics. He talks about a conference he attended where one of the speakers displayed a 1989 ad for a Tandy 5000 desktop. The ad proclaimed that this was the most powerful computer ever. Monitor and mouse were not included in the $8,499 price. The computer you have today is far faster and more efficient than one of the best computers in the market a quarter of a century ago. You can buy a Dell laptop computer for less than $400 that has a quad-core processor, 8 gigabytes of memory, and a hard drive with 1 terabyte of storage. You know, the original handheld cellular phone was the Motorola Dynatec 8000X. If you've never seen one, you might rent the 1987 Oliver Stone film, Wall Street. I would imagine you would laugh when you see Gordon Gekko pull out this brick of a phone to make a phone call. The 1983 price for this technological wonder of the day was $3,995. Today, nearly everyone has a cell phone and expects to pay less than $250 and sometimes less than $200 for a phone that does a lot more than make phone calls. You know, we benefit from these inventions of entrepreneurs, but we also benefit from the manufacturing efficiencies of a free market that put these devices in our hands for a fraction of their original cost. I'm Kirby Anderson, and that's my point of view.
From Giving Films, 90 Minutes in Heaven, based on a true story, in theaters September 11th, rated PG-13. More information at 90minutesinheaventhemovie.com.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Weekend Edition in studio with me. Today is Penna Dexter and Debbie Georgiadis, and we also have Sharon Albertson joining us. And you know, Penna, every year at this time, we like to focus on LifeChain. We have a link to lifechain.net, and I want to encourage our listeners throughout the country to go to that website, and then you can find out where one of these life chains will be. And I've stood out there holding those signs and had people honk and some people waving and others, you know, maybe not be so friendly. But it's just a great opportunity, right, to begin to testify for life this weekend.
Well, I think sometimes we just have to make statements about this and speak about the sanctity of human life. And certainly we had the Pope here this week. And just looking at some of the other stories out there, I mean, the Congress is supposed to be trying to stop abortion past 20 weeks. That's, you know, 5 months gestation. And they haven't even been able to do that. Some states have,
yes.
But the Congress hasn't. And then I saw this disturbing story. It was by Lila Rose yesterday talking about the abortion lobby and how they are now encouraging women to flaunt their abortions on social media with the hashtag shout your abortion. I mean, that's just disgusting and amazing. You know, I wrote recently about these abortion spas where they try to make it just so cushy and lovely with these nice robes and things like that and send them home with the, you know, second abortion pill. But so I think it is a good opportunity here in the fall to make a statement. And with us to do that is Sharon Albertson. She's a longtime pro-life activist. And she's a state director for Texas Life Chain and also a LifeChain.net coordinator. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Life Chain is October 4th. Just tell us, if people aren't familiar with what happens on that Sunday, what happens?
Okay, Life Chain is across the United States and Canada again this year in right at 1,600 cities and towns, many with multiple locations, so that 1,900 locations are listed on the website as verified. And people show up at the location. Signs are provided at the site that are very family-friendly. Royce Dunn, the national director in California. We do the website in Texas, and the signs are ordered from the printer in Colorado. So this really is National Life Chain. The signs are very much explaining our real hope for encouraging people to keep their babies. Adoption, the loving option. Jesus forgives and heals. Lord, forgive us and our nation. Abortion kills children. Abortion hurts women. El aborto mata niños, life the first inalienable right, pray to end abortion. Another one I like to hold is pregnant need help, 1-800-712-HELP.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, these, I mean, people that want to participate, you don't need to bring your own signs because Life Chain provides them.
Right.
And these are all, I mean, this way you kind of avoid some of the graphic ones. But there are some things that we have to be graphic about. And the Heritage Foundation was this week, and they told the story of a little boy who was born at like 22 weeks. His mother, her water broke, and she decided not to take this, I guess not to abort the baby, and then take the drastic drugs that would help her. She decided to risk her own health and go ahead and carry this little boy to term. And it shows a picture of him. He's like 3 years old now and just precious. And he's, you know, got a couple of minor problems. But But she chose life, and that's what we're talking about here, Sharon.
Right.
And we don't have to be disgustingly graphic, as some signs can be, but we can just make common sense about life with these signs and with just the ability of people to stand on a street corner and speak for life.
Right. It's a peaceful, prayerful public witness of pro-life Americans standing in honor of the 56 to 58 million lives lost to abortion, praying for our nation, for people in crisis situations, and for an end to abortion. It's a visual statement of solidarity by the Christian community that abortion kills children, and the church supports the sanctity of human life from the moment of conception to natural death. You probably can tell I'm reading that off of our mission statement.
But it's a great mission statement.
We really do. Every year we hear of young women who have decided not to have an abortion after seeing the signs and the people praying. I was talking to a man night before last who said a young girl had come up to him holding a baby, so he thought she was going to talk about her own baby experience. She said, actually, my mom was pregnant 20 years ago and was not married, didn't have a job, didn't know what she was going to do. She thought her only chance was to have an abortion. But she saw you holding a sign, and she told me to come and thank you because that baby was me. And now she's even more proud because I'm holding her first grandchild.
Wow.
That's so moving. I want to ask Sharon, you mentioned a moment ago on the 1900 locations, is that right?
Right.
So you pick locations, I assume they're high traffic areas.
Right.
Around the country. So anyone listening in any place you are can go to your website and figure out where to go. And did you say Sunday, October 4th?
Right.
Yeah.
Alternate date is October 25th. Always first Sunday of October is when most of that happened, but alternate date is last Sunday of October. So this year it's 25th. In case people are just hearing about it now and want to put together a life chain. Actually, Father Frank Pavone says any day is a good day for
yeah,
a life
true.
Chain. Just get some friends and go hold the signs by the road. On the back of the signs are songs and prayers for people to be praying during that hour or 90 minutes, whatever the group chooses. And so it really does have put into perspective why we are there.
Okay, it's lifechain.net, correct, Sharon?
Right, right.
Or you can click through from pointofview.net and go right through to the lifechain.net website. And that there people can find out if there's a location near them where there is a life chain, correct?
Right. Exactly.
Let me just mention, we've also posted the video, and I'm going to give everybody an assignment. That is to watch the video. It would only take a minute, and it's very well done, and it's got all sorts of quotes, not only from the scriptures, but even from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Talks about 90 minutes, one day, one goal. So take it and put it on your Facebook page so that you can start some conversation. We're giving you a week's notice, so that's good. And then if you go to lifechain.net, left-hand corner there, it has all the various states. And, of course, I can look down here and see every state where we broadcast, there's one. So I can just, since I'm in Texas right now, type in Texas, and then it shows which ones are already verified, and it takes, I'm still scrolling down, from all the places in Texas alone where there is a life chain already scheduled. And as you pointed out for just a minute, Sharon, if somebody says, well, there's not one in my community, we've given them enough time to get some of the information and make that available.
Exactly. We are so glad for the new life chains that are coming on board this year. Just a number of young people who are really excited about getting their friends to be out there. Of course, they need to know that this is a sacred time. This is not a time for just, you know, holding a sign, waving to people going by, but really to be praying for people in crisis situations. We just are so thankful. Again, last year we heard of a lady who drove past, I think it was in Georgia somewhere, and was expecting twins, thought she was going to have an abortion, and called them later and said, I decided to keep my twins because of seeing the song.
Wow.
I love those kind of stories. You know, Sharon, I was thinking about this abortion debate really has been going on since Roe versus Wade, I guess, and a lot of times it seems, I think the left or people who are strongly pro-choice have just kind of put the issue out of mind, or they adopt some mantra like woman's right to choose, reproductive justice, and they don't deal with the reality of what abortion actually is. And so these Planned Parenthood videotapes have helped. But this thing, this just your neighbors and your friends, your community with loving, simple, pro-life signs, I really think it's probably very impactful for people that you never hear about again. They realize, wow, these are people who could be home watching the football game or whatever it is they'd be doing, but this matters. And the messages, I love the sound of the messages you're describing in your signs. They're loving, they're life-embracing, they're uplifting. It's just, right. I imagine it's very powerful.
Right. We have had some people join the life chain, like bikers going by or someone driving by, and they see it and want to join the group. Then we've had a few times where we've heard someone was upset and came along and was talking to the people in a rather abusive way. In one instance here in the Dallas area, a lady was doing that. So one of the ladies in the life chain line started talking to her, and it turned out this young woman's mom had made her have an abortion when she was 16, and she had been carrying that guilt with her forever. So the lady in the life chain asked if she could pray with her. Oh, yeah, what does it matter? And so she prayed with her. When they were finished, she understood that she really could be forgiven, that it was not her fault, and her attitude was completely different. It gives me chills to tell you that.
Well, again, lifechain.net, and thank you so very much for reminding us. We've given everybody advance warning and an opportunity for you to get involved. So again, go to our website, pointofview.net. You'll find all the links that you need, and we'll take a break, come back with more right after this.
Point of View needs your prayers right now and your help. We are counting down the hours on our September Matching Challenge, a $50,000 gift from a ministry friend who has promised to double your own generous donation. But here's the rub. If you don't give, there's nothing to match. Please, whether it's $20 or $2,000, we need to hear from you before the 30th is over. A few more days. Call now. Give generously, 1-800-347-5151, or online at pointofview.net. 800-347-5151 and pointofview.net.
From Provident Films and Affirm Films comes War Room. Tony and Elizabeth Jordan's marriage is turning into a battle, and their daughter is caught in the crossfire until Elizabeth meets Miss Clara.
This is my favorite place in this house. I call it my war room.
And learns that prayer is a powerful weapon.
Fighting the good.
War Room. Now play. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. More information is available at warroomthemovie.com.
Point of View will continue after this.
You are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again is Kirby Anderson.
If you'd like to join us, 1-800-351-1212. Penna Dexter, and I'm so used to saying Kelly Shackelford, Debbie Georgiatis. Kelly is out today.
I know, but
he is at, and we were hoping to have him by phone, but he's busy speaking, so we gave him a pass on that. But yes, Kelly Shackelford is at the Values Voters Summit. We'll get all of the information from him next week when he comes back, or maybe we can have him call in early next week just to tell us what it was like. Penna's normally there, and we usually are calling her. Just before we get into another topic, let me just mention that over the last month, we have been encouraging you to give to Point of View, and it's really important. And if you notice on our website here, we say time is running out. And the reason for that is that we had a very generous donor say, I know that you've had a difficult summer, and sometimes giving drops during the summer. And we understand that. People are on vacation, people are out of kilter, and sometimes they forget to send in a gift, and we fully understand that. So that donor said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll put down a $50,000 match challenge, and if you can raise up to $50,000, I will match it. Of course, if you don't raise it, only match what you raise. Well, we aren't even close to reaching that match challenge, and we are coming to the end of September. And in case you forget, that last day of September is Wednesday. Now, you can be a procrastinator and wait till Tuesday night. I'd rather you didn't do that. But if you've been thinking about having your gift to Point of View matched, dollar for dollar, that means your gift of $50 becomes $100. A gift of $100 becomes $200. That is something I really wanted to challenge you to do. And today, as we've talked about some very important issues about the Speaker of the House stepping down, life chain, and now as we talk about all the Muslim topics, whether it's been the young boy that brought a clock to a school and people have accused the school of Islamophobia, or whether it's comments by Ben Carson or some of the other conversation that has happened this week. Certainly, if you value what we talk about here on Point of View, we would certainly encourage you to go to the website there, click on that button that says Salt and Light $50,000 Matching Challenge, and we would greatly appreciate that because it is a little tight sometimes in the fall after a lean summer, and so if you can help us out, we would greatly appreciate it. But let me go around the round table. Penna Dexter, Debbie Georgiadis, we have a couple of issues. Debbie, I know on your radio program you said there's more to this story than this young boy who took apart a clock, put it in a box, showed it to his teacher, and then got arrested. And we now know a little bit more. It turns out he did indeed take apart a clock that was kind of made in the 1970s, put it in a pencil case. It looked a lot like a bomb. His first teacher said, just put that away. Well, he didn't. And then he even took it to another class, and the bomb, if you will, it went off. It went ringing. And can you imagine the scare at that point? So, again, did they overreact? Well, we're starting to find out a little bit more about him and his family. What have we found out?
Yes, it is a very important thing for people who read anything about this story to really get a fuller picture. Number one, just quickly about the boy, both the principal and the police described him as evasive in not answering their questions and as stonewalling. And I think it's important to recognize that in if this happened 30 years ago, it would be a different context, but we're living in 2015 where we do have serious problems in this country, in schools, and with respect to radical Islam. And as to this young boy, he was 14. His family, his dad has been an activist. Actually, he ran for president of Sudan twice, his dad did, which is a Muslim country. He also, in America, has been a strong activist in what he describes as being an anti-Islamophobic activist. So he is someone looking for Islamophobia, claiming it exists, trying to cast the picture of America as Islamophobic. And now the stories come out that this young man's older sister, who is, I think, now 18, she was suspended from the same school district a few years ago based on comments she made that sounded threatening, that a student, a young girl, reported to the school, and this girl was suspended for these kind of threatening comments. And I think the biggest lesson for me to take away from this is this idea that Americans are rightfully concerned about radical Islam. We don't have to look further than September 11th, but if you want to look further, you can look at what's occurring around the world with respect to radical Islam, and we hear stories about people crossing our border, our porous border, that are either affiliated or really part of ISIS or Al-Qaeda. We are rightfully on high alert in America. And so this incident, this young boy did not bring a bomb to school, but he brought something to school that looked like a bomb. And to my sense, the parents immediately called in CAIR, C-A-I-R, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Yeah. That group, if you don't know about CAIR is very closely affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, dedicated to jihad, dedicated to radical Islam. And so it's just important to see this as, I think, a set play by this family to create a stir and quickly go to the media and then complain about the Islamophobic nature of American society. And to my sense, most Americans, we just simply want to live in peace, respect each other. People don't want to, they don't want to judge each other, but we have to be realistic in America. And the school, if they didn't react, imagine if this young boy brought this to school and it was a bomb and the parents or the school was afraid to comment because they don't want to be in the media and being accused of being Islamophobic. So to my sense, the school reacted just perfectly, and this is a reaction you have to expect in this kind of context.
We've also, you know, forget to whether he was Muslim or not, we've had white kids in places like Columbine and others engaged in certain activities, so obviously there was the racial component, but I do wonder if an Anglo-American kid brought something similar and then was, as you said, evasive. Now, there's privacy laws, so we don't right now know all the things he said, but what's leaked out is he was passive-aggressive, he was evasive, he was maybe even a little bit snarky about some of his comments. That doesn't make you feel good. That makes you wonder, what's he hiding? If he was just saying, oh, my mistake, my bad, I'll put this away and put it in my locker, but that's not what he did, and that's not how he reacted, as best as we can determine.
Right, and I know Penna probably has a comment, too, but I'll just jump in and say, we have three young adult children, but even when they were going through school, if they had invented something, I'm telling you, if you see these pictures online, if Ethan Hunt of Mission Impossible saw this suitcase, this pencil case, you would think it looks like a bomb. You would call the bomb squad. So if any of our children had built anything like that, we would have either told them they couldn't bring it to school or gone in with them, talked to the teacher or the principal, said, hey, this is just, you know, my son here wanted to try to invent a clock. You would have been careful to avoid any sense of suspicion to school, exactly the opposite of the way these parents conducted themselves.
Debbie, when you tell the story of the sister, it just makes me think about a family that probably these kids' whole life, there's been discussions at home about the Islamophobic nature of the country. And so, you know, this type of thing has been encouraged. The care that they could have put into his bringing that to school was not taken place. And, you know, after 9/11, we sort of vowed and decided to set aside our PC sensibilities for a while, or at least really forever, what would be the wise way of doing things so that we could keep our country safe. I mean, look what we do in the airports now. Well, at schools where kids are, you know, are we going to jettison that wise type of action? No. I mean, I think that's what they're asking us to do, but we're not. And I'm thinking back when I was in college, we used to have these bomb scares in the dorms.
Oh, wow.
And at night, in the middle of the night, I mean, I would have, like, pink rollers in my hair and my cute little quilted bathrobe, and we would be herded outside for a couple of hours to wait while the dorm was inspected. And there was never an actual reason for it. But the care that's taken wherever young people are gathered, they are a target. And I think that really the heart of the nation is to protect our young people. So the idea that they would take care in a situation like this, I think most Americans just see that as an absolute necessity.
I couldn't agree more. You know, you think about the mantra that is often you hear it at the airport or in public service ads. If you see something, say something. We are encouraged to report any suspicious appearing conduct, even a suitcase left unattended at the airport, which may just be because grandma ran in the restroom and left it out of her chair. But, you know, I think a really important point about all this is the dad's conduct and the conduct of care, the net impact on American society is to make the next person, the next teacher, principal, or just average citizen think, I'm not sure I should speak up. I don't want to be labeled as Islamophobic. It actually has a bad impact on safety for Americans and encourages us to be afraid to speak up when in other circumstances, safety or, you know, the American safety may rely on someone speaking up.
Well, again, if you're already a little bit concerned about if you see something, say something, and then you have this, I think it's going to cause people to be even more hesitant, and if we lose some lives over it, you're going to see the damage. So whether this was intentional or accidental, it hasn't had really good play, and I think it's going to change the safety that we have. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Ben Carson did have some things to say about being Islamic and whether or not he would vote for a Muslim president. And that is certainly a very important issue in the news as well. Second hour today, we're going to have a chance to talk about the Pope's visit, some of his comments, and we'll be hearing from an expert at the Media Research Center about some of the journalists and how they've covered him as well. Got a lot to cover. We'll do that right after these important messages.
Sexual mores in a culture are relaxed. It's not always just live and let live. Sometimes, sexual liberty runs right smack into religious liberty, and battle lines form. Some of the preliminary outcomes of these battles are discouraging, so it's great to report a victory in the case of a decorated Marine and Navy chaplain, and really for all chaplains in the U.S. military. Here's the story. Wes Motter served in the Marines before pursuing God's call to become a pastor. He became a Navy chaplain, endorsed by his denomination, the Assemblies of God. Wes was chaplain for Navy Special Forces Command, even serving a Navy SEAL unit. He received many honors and commendations from his superiors, but one commander, who initially gave him high performance marks, turned on him. In private counseling sessions, when asked about sexual conduct and same-sex marriage, Chaplain Motter responded with biblical truth. His gay married assistant complained to Captain Foz, Chaplain Motter's commander at the Naval Nuclear Power Command at Goose Creek, South Carolina. Captain Foz then accused the chaplain of being intolerant and unfit and deemed his counseling, quote, a recipe for tragedy. He relieved Chaplain Motter of most of his duties and recommended he be detached for cause and that he face a board of inquiry which would decide whether he be ejected from the Navy. Chaplain Motter's attorneys at Liberty Institute called this attack on him a clear test. If someone like Wes Motter could be toppled by the sexual revolution, they mused, what person of faith would be safe? Liberty Institute partnered with top law firm Wilmer Hale to defend Chaplain Motter. They dug in and prepared for a likely years-long battle. But on September 4th, the Navy informed Wes Motter that all charges against him had been dropped. He is totally reinstated, entirely exonerated, and can now continue as a chaplain, preaching biblical truth and counseling according to his Christian beliefs. He even gets to pick his next assignment. Captain Foz, who attempted to have Chaplain Motter removed from the military, was quickly retired from the Navy. 4 years ago, the U.S. military began allowing open homosexuals to serve. The implications of this and the Supreme Court's decision regarding same-sex marriage are being worked out in cases like Chaplain Motter's. A chaplain can be a great help to troops who struggle with sexual temptation, homosexual assault, and conflicts with their own faith and values. But chaplains don't always know which counselees have an agenda or only want affirmation for sinful behavior. Chaplains become targets for persecution. It's no accident that Chaplain Motter was just short of the 20-year mark at which members of the military can take retirement. The activists within the military figure, with a wife and kids to support, perhaps this guy can be intimidated and will set a precedent. But this chaplain stood strong, and his victory sends a strong signal. For Point of View, I'm Penna Dexter.
Now, back to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Weekend edition, if you'd like to join us, 1-800-351-1212. We've put lots of things on the table. Those of you that listen online just heard Penna Dexter's commentary on Chaplain Wes Motter. We talked about that last week, one of the many victories. And so let me encourage you, if you'd like to read that commentary or receive it, here's a place for you to do so. We always send it out on Saturdays, and it's already on the website right now. Also, we finally got on the website, just taking a few minutes, Fight to Defund Planned Parenthood. It takes for into account the fact that we might have a new Speaker of the House, whether it's worth encouraging your two senators, but most importantly, your one representative to stand strong on that issue. So we've given you an action item. So there's lots to read and lots to talk about. But what about Ben Carson? Poor Ben Carson. He would just ask a straightforward question. You know, could you ever vote for a Muslim for president? Now, you can issue all sorts of disclaimers, which I often call the death by disclaimers, okay? Yes, Article 6 in the Constitution does not require a religious test. Yes, not all Muslims believe in Sharia law, the caliphate, and jihad. You could add three or four disclaimers before you say yes, but he just simply gave a short answer, and there's been a firestorm ever since. I know, what do we think about this issue? Because, indeed, it's going to come up again. Even if we don't have a Muslim running for president right now, we do have at least one or two Muslims that are in Congress. We have lots of Muslims that are running for political office at state and local levels. So the issue is even broader than that one question that Ben Carson was asked about.
Ben Carson is not good at sound bites, but in this case, his answer was perhaps a little bit too short. he probably should have explained what Islam is.
Yeah.
It's not only a religion. It's also a system like communism, Islamofascism. It actually top down decrees how you live your life in so many ways that most Americans don't agree with. He's saying not shouldn't vote for a person for Islam. That's not enacting a religious test. That's just saying it's not good to vote for a person for president that's a Muslim. He did try to differentiate between somebody running for Congress and that he would then look at that person and see what policies they advocated and all of that. And so that's probably a better way to explain it and look at it. But you, when you drill down on their history in their life, which you really need to do, and the policies they support, I mean, that's where you make your decision in all elections. That's where you should make it. Now, are they a Muslim? Does that cause you to look into some things more strongly? Yes. Ben Carson, he's just a little politically naive still. And so, you know, that's a problem. And I think that's ultimately going to be the problem that probably ends up keeping him out of the nomination.
Debbie, what would you say to Ben Carson or his staff or somebody who has a real problem with some of the comments he's made?
You know, I think Ben Carson, I completely agree with Penna said a moment ago that he, I think his answer in substance was right, but he said it so poorly that it really kind of backfired against him. If you, and I think there is in America, we love our First Amendment, we love freedom of religion, we love the notion of respecting other religions, and I think in America the basic problem is ignorance about what Islam really is and what it really teaches. So if you don't know anything about Islam, and then you have a presidential candidate say we can't have any Muslims be president or we shouldn't support a Muslim for president, it makes people just think that's just bigoted. They don't know why you would say that. And so I think it was incumbent on him and still is, and he hasn't backed down, which I do commend him, to say, you know, a core notion of Islam is jihad. A core notion of Islam is Sharia. Sharia is a forced set of laws that everyone must follow, and therefore we'd lose the American rule of law. Being able to talk a little bit about those things, and ultimately in Islam, the goal is to attempt to impose the caliphate on the whole world. If you can say enough about what Islam is, what you're saying is, if a person embraces that, they are not able to hold the office of president and support the American Constitution. They're inconsistent. And I think then he would sound a lot better.
Yeah, under Islam, a Christian or any other religion besides Islam becomes a second-class citizen. That is completely antithetical to our Constitution. So, you know, there's your answer.
Yes. Let me quote from a Muslim, a moderate Muslim. You know, the other day when I talked about this, some people said, where are the moderate Muslims speaking out? Well, there are a few, and one of them is Dr. Tawfiq Hamid, and he's been on once or twice, and he was a radical Muslim, actually was part of a radical Islamic organization in Egypt. But eventually, it started awakening his human conscience. And when he started thinking about, what am I teaching and what are we believing? He now actually is one of those very few individuals out there that's trying to teach what he calls a modern, peaceful interpretation of Islam. But at the same time, one of the things I thought was so interesting is he says, as a Muslim and particularly a member of a former radical Islamic group, I can state unequivocally that Dr. Carson is correct. Without a single exception, the approved Islamic literature teaches violent principles such as killing apostates, beating women, killing gays, enslaving female war prisoners for sexual purposes. And he says, if anyone doubts it, then look at this. You can look at the fact that right now there's a real control on what is considered to be the approved texts of Islam. And he points that you can look at leading Islamic scholars at Al-Azhar University or the religious authorities in Saudi Arabia, which are the two kind of major Sunni religious bodies, and you can see that they approve all of this. And so the challenge right now for a lot of the moderate Muslims who say, wait a minute, we don't believe in this, and we should be elected to office, and we would like to have more opportunity to speak out against it. The difficulty is that these Islamic texts are pretty much controlled by individuals that believe in what you just said, Sharia, jihad, and a caliphate. That makes it real difficult for some of the moderate Muslims.
It would be nice if they would form, sort of coalesce with one another to give each other strength.
Mm-hmm.
They have not been able to do that. It's the organizations who say that they are going to stand against intolerance against or Islamophobia who are the really the go-to organizations for the media. There needs to be some sort of organization formed, I think, among these people and get some scholarly information and papers out there and get some, you know, university classes about it. They've got to do something or, you know, their message won't get out.
Yeah, you know, there's a gentleman who's actually the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. named Hassan al-Banna.
Oh, yes.
And he wrote, he wrote lengthy articles about the basic thing: you cannot be a devout Muslim and refuse to commit jihad. And jihad means, in his words, essentially, you must convert or kill infidels. You are incapable of being a devout Muslim based on his, and he's not just, you know, talk off the top of his head. He's pointing back to texts in the Quran and to other early writings in Islam. So this is a guy who founded Muslim Brotherhood, which is still obviously an active organization today that CARE is affiliated with. So I think part of what happens, what also would help when Ben Carson or other people were trying to explain concerns about Islam, is to point to say, we're not saying what we think. I'm going to tell you what they said. This is what this founder of Muslim Brotherhood wrote about. He wrote at great length about it. And the two other doctrines are this hijra idea, which is jihad via immigration. That's right. What hijra is. It is sending people as immigrants to commit jihad in
like the
country.
Refugee crisis right now.
Exactly. The other one is taqiyya, if not pronouncing it correctly, the idea that you are permitted,
you can lie
in the name of Islam, to support Islam.
Yeah, Surah 3, and as gives you the justification to misrepresent your intents. So again, those are some very key issues, and I think Ben Carson raised them this week. And so if you'd like to join our conversation, we're going to go to a break, Ed, but when we come back, we'll take some of your phone calls, 1-800-351-1212. Talked about the resignation of the Speaker of the House. We've talked about the life chain. We've talked about the clock boy, if you want to call him that, and we've talked about whether a Muslim should be elected to president. And if you'd like to join us, that number, 1-800-351-1212. Don't forget, as we go to a break, that this is a time for you to consider what you might do to support Point of View. We have our matching fund up to $50,000, and time is running out. September 30th is the last day for us to qualify. It's a great opportunity, but we certainly encourage you, especially during this break, to visit our website, pointofview.net, and take some action. Of course, we have some action items on defunding Planned Parenthood, so take the time to go to pointofview.net. You'll find a lot more. We come back, of course, we'll talk about Pope Francis, but we'll also take your phone calls. All that coming up right after this.
It is riddle time. What is often misunderstood and ticks down faster than a Texas student's homemade clock? A Point of View matching challenge. All right, that was a really bad way to get your attention. There are so many issues today where wisdom is needed. You need as many allies as you can get in a time like this. And I believe the nation needs Point of View. We have a friend who thinks so too. So much so, this friend has put their money where their worldview is, and is challenging you to do the same thing. For every gift you give, this friend will double it, an equal amount, up to $50,000. Whether you feel like your means are great or small, just do what you can and know it will be doubled. Bottom line, we need you to dig down. We have just a few days left in this challenge. Double your impact when you give generously. 1-800-347-5151 or online at pointofview.net. 800-347-5151 and pointofview.net. Thank you.
Point of View will continue after this.
Across America, live, this is Point of View.
And now, Kirby Anderson.
Thank you for joining us. Second hour today here on Point of View. It is our weekend edition in Studio Penedexter, Debbie Georgiadis. And if you'd like to join us, 1-800-351-1212. Previously, we've been talking about the issue of Islam and some of the comments by Ben Carson, so I see we have a few phone calls on that. This hour, we're going to move into, after those phone calls, a conversation about Pope Francis and some of the things that he has said in some of the speeches. We'll also be hearing from Julia Seymour, who is the Assistant Managing Editor for the Media Research Center, has some comments about that later this hour as well. But let's take some phone calls and get your comments. We'll head out to Georgia first, Good News Network, and Cameron, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Kirby. Thanks for taking my call.
What would you like to add to the conversation?
Well, I have to come right out and admit that I'm a Ben Carson supporter. I have been since the 2013 prayer breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
I've been praying for him to run, and so far that's been an answered prayer in itself. But
he's done extremely well.
Yeah, he has. I'm one of many evangelicals that I know who support him, and although he may have not said it perfectly, whether or not he realized it at the time, or intended to at the time, I think he did himself a big favor in this situation.
Seemed to help his campaign. You know, again, he and Donald Trump don't back down, and everybody's saying, well, if he doesn't back down, that'll be the end of the campaign. Didn't turn out that way for either Donald Trump or Ben Carson.
Right, right. And you know, Rahm Emanuel on the left has said before, you know, never waste a good controversy. And I think that that applies here. I mean, a recent poll shows that, I don't know, 40 to 45% of Americans view the president as a Muslim. So this could play into Dr. Carson's hands quite well, especially with those voters who are suspicious of the president. So I also think the Clockface incident could contribute to a voter perception of this. That's my comment. I haven't heard anybody on your show say that this could play into Ben Carson's hands quite well.
Well, I think you brought up what we had noticed, and that is fundraising and support for him increased after this. And he did not back down.
He didn't back down. It's so refreshing. I'm loving this campaign, really, because we're having people that are not backing down, that are speaking their minds. And, you know, I disagree a little bit. I think that he sometimes makes naive comments and shows himself as unpresidential. And I think in the long run that hurts him. But, boy, am I glad he's standing for his principles and speaking the truth, because we need that kind of dialogue going on in our country. And the fact that this man gets up, you know, every time and refuses to be politically correct.
Yes.
Yet he does it in a, mm-hmm. he does it in a polite and winsome way.
Mm-hmm. Gentle.
Unlike Donald Trump.
Yeah. Very good. Let me take another phone call real quickly, because that'll get us into some other comments as well. Leslie in California, KYCC, what would you like to add to the conversation?
Hi, Kirby. I'd just like to say that I've met a few Muslims who are wonderful, peace-loving people.
Sure.
But when a Muslim runs for political office, I believe his agenda is strictly to further the cause of Islam and Sharia law.
And I do know some that maybe if they ran for office really just believe in the Constitution, believe in our country and all that. A lot of it has to do with, you know, how do you feel? And I like the three-fold question by David Georgiadis. What do you think about Sharia? What do you think about jihad? And what do you think about the caliphate? And if you are 0 for 3, that's a little different. But if you're 3 for 3, I think we all know the answer for that one as well. But there's a place where I think we have to have some discernment. But certainly we would recognize, and I love the way John Smirik said just a minute ago in one of his pieces, if a candidate were a pious Orthodox Muslim, we would be crazy to do otherwise. Because if he says, I'm Sharia observant and I'm a devout Muslim and I believe that the moral law is contained in the infallible and unchangeable tenets of Sharia, anybody around the table want to vote for that individual? I think we know the answer to that question, don't we?
Not a chance. I also think that Dr. Carson's comments are being heard and assessed by the American people in the context of the issue about the Syrian refugees who may be coming here. That to stop the ultimate flood of refugees, we need to solve the problem with ISIS, because there will just be more and more and more until ISIS is stopped. But the Syrian refugee question of whether and when to bring them here and how many is all tied up with being discerning about Islam, because people, you know, Al-Qaeda has been quoted, ISIS has been quoted saying, of course, especially ISIS, of course, within Syrian refugees, we are including our own people, ISIS supporting people within, among these refugee groups. And Americans want to feel safe. They want to feel like the government's vetting people well. So this threat of this vague feeling of we have to be protecting America from radical Islam is in the back of people's thought, just because of the Syrian refugee question as well.
Mm. Let's take another phone call. We'll head out to, I guess, Massachusetts this time, WSEW. I believe you're a exchange student. So, Pamela, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, I am not an exchange student. I'm a public teacher.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misread that.
That's okay, who hosted an exchange student.
Okay.
She was from Casablanca, and she was a Muslim. And she and my daughter and girlfriends in high school at the time had some very nice exchanges with her about her Muslim faith that she was, you know, born into and raised up in. And she was very adamant and very saddened that the radical Islamists and the ISIS and the extremists have distorted, you know, what she knows as her faith, and just kept like shaking her head, you know, no, this is not us, this is not what we believe. And I did like the comments I just heard earlier about having discernment. That word needs to be overstated all the time, because there needs to be discernment in a lot of things that we do in this lifetime. And my family, part of my family, actually, there was one family member who married my aunt. This was a while back, you know, I would say 30, 40 years ago. He's from Syria, and he was welcomed and, you know, into the family, just like one of us. We are a Christian family, and some of us are Catholics, and some of us are different denominations of the Christian faith. But discernment is the answer here, because, you know, we need to be peace-loving people and understanding who we are accepting and how they are brought into, you know, our great, you know, United States, and somehow, some way that has to be discerned, and that's the word of the day, discernment.
Sure. Spiritual and political discernment. Very good. Thank you.
You know, if you put together her, Pamela, and also Leslie's call, I think the word discernment is important. And Leslie kind of made the point that, yes, she's known some peace-loving Muslims, but if they're running for office, you do have to question the motive why. Not necessarily that their motive is bad, but I think at this point in history, you have to look at them and say, why are they running? That would be the wise thing to do, to look into their history, their faith, and everything else, because they're, you know, right now, we know there's this effort to take control, and there's this whole idea of the caliphate, and that caliphate can expand to, you know, our country, and that would be their motivation. So you have to ask why. You have to ask that question. That's the only wise, discerning way to do it.
Some people said, well, I've never heard from a moderate Muslim. We've had Zudi Jasser on, and we've talked about Tawfiq Hamid, and there are a few, but they're very few, and I like Penna's idea. Let's form a coalition, maybe the anti-care coalition, that says there are some moderate Muslims out there and they deserve some attention too. Let's take a break. We'll be back right after this.
This is Viewpoints with Kirby Anderson.
You know, we all benefit these days from the economies of free market that allow for the invention of entrepreneurs to be manufactured at a small cost so that we can all enjoy them. We may not understand some of the complex economic issues around us, but we can see their impact in the prices we pay for sophisticated technology. John Tamney gives some great examples in his book Popular Economics, What the Rolling Stones, Downton Abbey, and LeBron James Can Teach You About Economics. He talks about a conference he attended where one of the speakers displayed a 1989 ad for a Tandy 5000 desktop. The ad proclaimed that this was the most powerful computer ever. Monitor and mouse were not included in the $8,499 price. The computer you have today is far faster and more efficient than one of the best computers in the market a quarter of a century ago. You can buy a Dell laptop computer for less than $400 that has a quad-core processor, 8 gigabytes of memory, and a hard drive with 1 terabyte of storage. You know, the original handheld cellular phone was the Motorola Dynatec 8000X. If you've never seen one, you might rent the 1987 Oliver Stone film, Wall Street. I would imagine you would laugh when you see Gordon Gekko pull out this brick of a phone to make a phone call. The 1983 price for this technological wonder of the day was $3,995. Today, nearly everyone has a cell phone and expects to pay less than $250 and sometimes less than $200 for a phone that does a lot more than make phone calls. You know, we benefit from these inventions of entrepreneurs, but we also benefit from the manufacturing efficiencies of a free market that put these devices in our hands for a fraction of their original cost. I'm Kirby Anderson, and that's my point of view.
From Giving Films, 90 Minutes in Heaven, based on a true story, in theaters September 11th, rated PG-13. More information at 90minutesinheaventhemovie.com.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-800-351-1212. We're going to talk about the Pope in just a minute. Let me take one more phone call. We'll head up to New Hampshire, WSEW. Bob, what would you like to add to the conversation today?
Yes, Kirby, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that of all the candidates, and I've seen them during the debate, I can't think of a better candidate to be asked and answer that question about a Muslim being a president. If anyone's had the opportunity to read the book or watch the video, Gifted Hands, about Ben Carson, he's certainly an avid and strong Christian, number one. Number two, he doesn't do anything, even in his career. When he was the first one to separate and conjoin twins at the head, he spent the better part of his preparation doing research after research, and I'm certain, based upon his approach to dealing with that which he knew and was foreknown in the world, you know, as a neurologist, that he put much effort in doing background in all the subjects to which he was going to be questioned upon, number one. Number two, the second thing I just wanted to say, I can't get out of my head the image of George Stephanopoulos interviewing Barack Obama when he was first running as president.
I remember you're going to talk about where he said at one point talks about his Muslim faith, and then
yes, exactly.
And George Stephanopoulos says, you mean your Christian faith? Oh, yeah.
He had to correct himself, right. He says, I'm glad that the senator from Arizona was running at the time has not said anything about my Muslim religion. And it came out so, you know, normal. And then George Stephanopoulos clearly said, you mean Christian religion? Oh, yes, Christian. You know, and that
could
was
be a slip
right
of the tongue,
of
or could mean something else. But again, it's a good point. It's a very good point. I've had a chance to meet Ben Carson. I've met his wife. I've been on a stage with him. I've interviewed him a number of times. Such a quality individual. And wherever he ends up, I know he will be a real blessing. And if he does not end up being the president or a vice president and serves in the cabinet, I'm voting for him to be Surgeon General, Secretary of Health and Human Services. We deserve a man of that caliber in the office, for sure.
There was something up at Red State this week, and the article is titled, Now We Know Why the President Still Pretends to Be a Christian. And it talks about, it basically lines out the percentage of the populace that fits into various categories. We still have a nation that overwhelmingly people declare themselves to be Christians. So, you know, it's a political statement. I mean, I don't say that President Obama is a Muslim, but I have my definition of what a Christian is. It's not just a label that you are a non-Jew or a non-Muslim. There's a faith involved in that, and I haven't seen much evidence of it.
I haven't either. Let's bring to the microphone now Julia Seymour. She is the assistant managing editor for the Media Research Center business section, and we have posted a very good piece, which we have on our website, 5 Hard Left Issues Where Journalists Show Their Love for Pope Francis. We're going to spend some time talking about Pope Francis. We'll continue taking some of your questions and comments about Islam. Assistant Managing Editor for MRC Business, also an individual that graduated from Liberty University with a bachelor's degree in mass communications. She's been on all sorts of various television and radio programs, and I won't go through her long resume because I want to hear from her. Julia, thank you for joining us today here on Point of View.
Thank you so much for having me.
We will be talking about the Pope in just a minute, but I thought you could start us off by talking about the fact that when the media covers the Pope, they ignore his stands on abortion and mainstream marriage, traditional marriage, whatever you want to call it, but they spend a lot of time talking about, what, economic inequality, climate, alarmism? Tell us what you found.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw this, you know, in the coverage this week. They didn't, the media did very little to say or repeat what the Pope had said about religious freedom. We've seen them ignore his comments on abortion and life in the past. And yet they love when Pope Francis talks about economics because he has very critical view of capitalism. He complains about income inequality. He complains about wealth. He has called for a revolution to deal with, you know, on climate change issues. He thinks that needs to, the way that that's being handled is wrong and it needs to change. And he's been credited with helping reestablish a relationship between U.S. and Cuba.
So again, some very important things that we have seen covered in a way that I think is a little bit disturbing. And, you know, George Will the other day pointed out that, you know, he grew up in a time in which you had Perón in power. You had the redistribution of income in Argentina, which basically moved Argentina from the fourth highest GDP in the world to 63rd today. So yeah. If that's all I knew about economics, what I experienced in Argentina and saw some of the crony capitalism and almost fascism there, I'm not sure I'd be very positive about the free market either.
Right. And I've definitely heard people pointing out that what he grew up under was corporatism. It wasn't capitalism. But if he had been told that it was capitalism all this time, that could very well be the source of his views on this subject.
Julia, thanks for joining us. This is Penna Dexter, and I read Peggy Noonan's piece for the weekend today, and of course, Peggy Noonan is famously Catholic, and she really has a soft spot in her heart for all popes, I think, even this one in some senses, and she said, okay, you got John Paul II and you got Benedict, who are basically conservatives on a lot more than this pope is, so mm-hmm. I guess it's their turn, meaning the left and the progressives. What do you think of a statement like that?
Well, I'm not Catholic, so I can't come at it from that perspective. But I think that she's right that Pope Francis is very different from his two predecessors, and that's precisely what the media have been wanting. They've championed him as a different kind of pope and a pope who's breaking the mold. And I think that the media wants him to be even more liberal and views him as even more liberal as he may actually be.
Go ahead, Debbie.
This is Debbie Georges. Hi there. You know, I was noticing that Marco Rubio made a comment I thought was, I think the American, it's a reasonable way for American Catholics to listen to the Pope's speeches and positions. He said, in matters of spiritual, or matters of that of spiritual matters, such as marriage and abortion, or marriage and life, that he views the Pope's views to be infallible, that he is the descendant of Peter, he sits in the chair of Peter, what he says is infallible. But as to all other issues, economic in nature, he's just a man, and I disagree with him. And I think that was really a kind of a brave thing for Marco Rubio to say, but also a very realistic statement about what the Pope should and shouldn't be speaking about, and whether his views are entitled to the deference many Catholics would normally give to the Pope's views.
Yeah, I've certainly heard that from individual Catholic friends in discussing this issue and explaining what they believe as far as where the infallibility part comes into play. And so that distinction, I think, is important, and I don't think it's one that the media really makes, because I think a lot of people in media are kind of clueless when it comes to anybody's face and what that means and how that plays out.
But let's talk about that, because in your article, you point out that usually when the media does cover religion in any form, they give two sides. This is what Franklin Graham said, but here's one of his detractors. But in this case,
right.
Once the Pope says it, that you do not get an alternative perspective on income inequality. You do not get an other perspective on the Pope's anti-capitalist message. You don't get a different perspective on the Pope's embrace of climate alarmism. So it seems to me, and that's kind of the point of your piece, we didn't see the mainstream media giving even close to two sides on this particular set of issues.
No, they're not. And a great example from ABC World News just last month, talking about the Pope's upcoming visit to the U.S. Of course, he's here now. And David Muir was talking about one of the Pope's most popular tweets being that inequality is the root of social evil. And he was talking to some students in Rome. He spoke to four different students and quoted a couple of them, and they were saying, you know, I hope the Pope doesn't hold back when he goes to the U.S. and when he's discussing income inequality. And then he went and found two couples as well, married couples, American tourists in Rome, who were excited about the Pope coming to America and about how different he is and calling him the people's Pope. So they're piling on supporters for this pope. This is not what we saw in the case of Pope Benedict. They were constantly bashing him. People were calling him a criminal. People were, it was very, very negative coverage of his predecessor.
Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time. So again, I want to thank you, Julia, for writing this piece. We've posted it on our website and appreciate the good work at the Media Research Center.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take some more of your phone calls. Perhaps you have some comments about what the Pope has said, but don't forget, this is an opportunity, as we have mentioned, for you to support Point of View. And we, again, have that $50,000 matching fund. The deadline is September 30th. As we take a break, this would be a good time for you to visit the website, pointofview.net, and we'd love to hear from you. Let's take a break. We'll come back with more right after this.
Point of View needs your prayers right now and your help. We are counting down the hours on our September Matching Challenge, a $50,000 gift from a ministry friend who has promised to double your own generous donation. But here's the rub. If you don't give, there's nothing to match. Please, whether it's $20 or $2,000, we need to hear from you before the 30th is over. A few more days. Call now. Give generously, 1-800-347-5151, or online at pointofview.net. 800-347-5151 and pointofview.net.
From Provident Films and Affirm Films comes War Room. Tony and Elizabeth Jordan's marriage is turning into a battle, and their daughter is caught in the crossfire until Elizabeth meets Miss Clara.
This is my favorite place in this house. I call it my war room.
And learns that prayer is a powerful weapon. War Room. Now playing. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. More information is available at warroomthemovie.com.
Point of View will continue after this.
You are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again is Kirby Anderson.
Half hour, if you'd like to join us, it's our weekend edition, Penedexter, and again, Debbie Georgiadis, and we've already had a chance to hear from Julia Seymour today and earlier with Sharon Albertson. And if you did not hear all of the program, the opportunity for you to listen to it again is on the website. You can download the podcast and listen to it, or go to the live cast at our YouTube channel and give you a chance to hear it again or pass it on to someone else that maybe needs to hear some of this. George Will wrote about the Pope's fact-free flamboyance. I won't go into all the details here, but I gave a couple of the facts and figures. There was a time not so long ago when the country of Argentina had a gross domestic product of 14. It was 14th in the world. Today it's 63rd. Of course, that's where, of course, the Pope grew up. But one of the biggest issues is that he has been very critical of the free market, what I've called sort of an anti-capitalist message. And yet, if you want to explain why people are coming out of poverty, we've talked about this with Wayne Grudem. We've talked about this with various people like Arthur Brooks at the American Enterprise Institute. But the number of people living in extreme poverty, people that make $1.25 or less a day around the world, used to be at 50%. Now it's at 22%. And I just saw another statistic says maybe now it's down to 17%. I had a guest a couple of months ago on here that said if this trend continues, within another decade or two, at least extreme poverty in the world might not even exist anymore. And I think the answer to that is the free market. So those are some of the kind of counter arguments that need to be out there. You have 700 million people who were living in extreme poverty who no longer are living in extreme poverty. So before you criticize the free market, unless you have a better idea, that one seems to be working pretty well.
Well, Robert Rector at the Heritage Foundation has been writing lately about the situation of the poor in the United States. And if you go into their home, you see there's normally a flat screen TV and at least one car. And, you know, the lifestyle is, it's nothing that we would have considered poor three decades ago. So that's one. And, you know, just for the fact that this Pope has never been here and now he's been here, there's a part of me that wonders if he just could come here like Alexis de Tocqueville came here and just observe the United States and see how our freedom and our policies have actually affected the lives of Americans. And, you know, the liberty and not the coercive type redistribution of wealth type policies that he has advocated, our liberty is the source of our strength here. And we have really respected property rights here rather than clamp down on them. And that's been another reason why we've had prosperity. Another Wall Street Journal columnist, Bill McGurn, who I think is a Catholic, too. He was in the Reagan administration. And he writes, is it not a tragedy that a pope who whose heart belongs to the poor reserves all his moral outrage for the one economic system that has already lifted billions of desperate people out of poverty? So if he's honest intellectually and he has spent time here, and this is his first visit, perhaps there will be some evolution in his values. We'll see.
I sure think there should be. I find it astonishing, as you're alluding to, Penna, that you can grow up in a country like Argentina, and you can look at other South American countries and see the difference in affluence between those countries and America. And in America, maybe just the image of America and other places in the world, the people that the Pope listens to, they may describe America as a place of great affluence and or extreme income inequality. And we have, you know, poor and rich. But when you come to America, you actually live here and look around. I hope that he really does get a deep view of America while he's here. There just isn't the poverty here like there is worldwide. As you're saying, the poorest here have all sorts of Western modern conveniences and comforts. And I don't have the data in front of me, but even the percentage of people who are considered poor in America have air conditioning and cell phones. I think there's just I think if you're going to opine on the national stage or in Congress, it's incumbent on you to gather facts and not to spew, political ideology or economic assumptions. It's incumbent on you to really look at the facts, because in South America, where he's from, Argentina, we can talk about Venezuela, Brazil, the level of affluence is much less. And in America, because we have affluence, we have a generous, noble society Americans are very generous in our donations to other countries. We're generous in our donations to each other within our own country. And that affluence is tied to free markets. And so the last thing I know, I'm probably taking more time than I'm supposed to, but in Argentina, what the Pope may have observed growing up is what you alluded to a moment ago, Kirby, but it's not free markets in the sense that we in America defend and exalt, really, free markets. It is a crony capitalism with big government locking arms with big business and controlling everything, and that does cause poverty, and it does not lead to as much affluence in America. That's part of what the activity of grassroots people is noticing that what we have in the American left in Washington is, again, the locking arms with big business, which tends to hurt freedom and opportunity and ultimately wealth production.
One of the questions I want to put on the table came from what you mentioned just a minute ago, Debbie, and that is Marco Rubio, I think, said it best, and that is he believes the Pope is infallible on theological issues, and we can have a discussion about that another day, but that does not extend to political issues. And I've noticed a difference. The Pope talks about issuing encyclicals about life and about marriage. He's not really calling for a debate or a discussion about that, because there's really no debate. You know, it's very obvious what the Bible has to say about abortion and about life and about marriage. But in this particular case, when we talked about economic issues, economic inequality or climate change, he says we need to have a dialogue. And I'm saying, okay, let's have a dialogue. You know, we're not disrespecting the Pope. I don't want any of our Catholic listeners to feel like, well, I can't say this against the Pope because the Pope says let's have a dialogue. Well, I'm all for it. Let's have a dialogue. And if your goal is to help the poor, right now the attempt to try to remove the free market and replace it with something like socialism, or the attempt to implement what I think are some really draconian policies to deal with climate change, are going to hurt the poor. So we can debate the policies because we think we have a better answer than the one that he's putting forward.
Well, one area that he's spoken well on has been the topic of religious liberty. And
yes,
you can tie them together in a sense because, when the Bible does talk about the poor, I don't think it's a big directive to government to deal with the poor. And the Catholic Church has been certainly probably one of the best worldwide examples of an organization that helps the poor through church organizations, through parachurch groups that spring up from the Catholic Church. And so his, I think that appropriately, he can come to the United States and look at President Obama and ask him to uphold religious liberty, which he did, because that is not what our administration is doing. As a matter of fact, many of the incursions into religious liberty that are taking place now are starting to hurt and even close Catholic organizations that are helping people, you know, for instance, orphans or the Little Sisters of the Poor. I mean, they are under legal attack.
Here's a good one. He met with the Little Sisters
of
the Poor. And
yeah.
How many of you
cool.
would know that if you did not hear that on Point of View right now?
See, that was a cool move on his part.
Yeah, but it also shows back to what Julia Seymour was pointing out. That didn't get covered. You know, any comment about abortion, anything about marriage, that doesn't get covered. Meets with the Little Sisters of the Poor. You would not know it if you hadn't read, I guess, Gary Bauer's piece or you'd listen to Point of View right now. That's the only way you would know about that, because the mainstream media only wants to talk about climate change and the evils of capitalism. That's the problem.
Yeah, I do wonder. I love that he spoke about religious liberty, and we talk so often on this show with specific examples of cases, whether it's a baker who does not wish to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex wedding. We've had countless cases we talk about in this show on Friday afternoon, and I was happy to hear that the Pope raised that issue. I would love to know, what is the response of the elected officials who are Catholic, who are sitting in, who are on the American left? What is the answer? Because the American left is extremely intolerant of religious liberty. What their answer is, what President Obama's answer was. And the other thing that's interesting is, prior to coming here, the Pope visited Cuba, which up until recently has had very little, under communism, had very little religious liberty. Now they're talking about they're building churches. But, you know, what is the message of the Pope to that largely, what was largely Catholic nation? And how receptive will the new government be, especially with their new relationship with America, to the notion they really have to honor religious liberty?
Yeah, some very good questions. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll take some more phone calls. And also, I thought we might at least acknowledge that we now have two fewer candidates running on the Republican side. We might have one additional one running on the Democratic side. So we might mention that. We'll also take some phone calls if you'd like to join us. 1-800-351-1212. Let me give you your action items. Action item number one is, if you wanted to contact your representative about defunding Planned Parenthood, we think this may be a very significant time to do so, because after all, we are going to see a change in who the Speaker of the House might be. So your letter or your email to an individual that is representing you to stand strong will be very important. And of course, our other action item, as we've said before, our time is running out and we have this $50,000 matching fund. You can help us out financially. We would greatly appreciate it. We'd like to meet the match. We'll take a break and take some more phone calls right after this.
Sexual mores in a culture are relaxed. It's not always just live and let live. Sometimes sexual liberty runs right smack into religious liberty and battle lines form. Some of the preliminary outcomes of these battles are discouraging. So it's great to report a victory in the case of a decorated Marine and Navy chaplain, and really for all chaplains in the U.S. military. Here's the story. Wes Motter served in the Marines before pursuing God's call to become a pastor. He became a Navy chaplain, endorsed by his denomination, the Assemblies of God. Wes was chaplain for Navy Special Forces Command, even serving a Navy SEAL unit. He received many honors and commendations from his superiors, but one commander, who initially gave him high performance marks, turned on him. In private counseling sessions, when asked about sexual conduct and same-sex marriage, Chaplain Motter responded with biblical truth. His gay married assistant complained to Captain Foz, Chaplain Motter's commander at the Naval Nuclear Power Command at Goose Creek, South Carolina. Captain Foz then accused the chaplain of being intolerant and unfit and deemed his counseling, quote, a recipe for tragedy. He relieved Chaplain Motter of most of his duties and recommended he be detached for cause and that he face a board of inquiry which would decide whether he be ejected from the Navy. Chaplain Motter's attorneys at Liberty Institute called this attack on him a clear test. If someone like Wes Motter could be toppled by the sexual revolution, they mused, what person of faith would be safe? Liberty Institute partnered with top law firm Wilmer Hale to defend Chaplain Motter. They dug in and prepared for a likely years-long battle. But on September 4th, the Navy informed Wes Motter that all charges against him had been dropped. He is totally reinstated, entirely exonerated, and can now continue as a chaplain, preaching biblical truth and counseling according to his Christian beliefs. He even gets to pick his next assignment. Captain Foss, who attempted to have Chaplain Motta removed from the military, was quickly retired from the Navy. 4 years ago, the U.S. military began allowing open homosexuals to serve. The implications of this and the Supreme Court's decision regarding same-sex marriage are being worked out in cases like Chaplain Motta's. A chaplain can be a great help to troops who struggle with sexual temptation, homosexual assault, and conflicts with their own faith and values. But chaplains don't always know which counselees have an agenda or only want affirmation for sinful behavior. Chaplains become targets for persecution. It's no accident that Chaplain Motta was just short of the 20-year mark at which members of the military can take retirement. The activist within the military figure, with a wife and kids to support, perhaps this guy can be intimidated and will set a precedent. But this chaplain stood strong, and his victory sends a strong signal. For Point of View, I'm Penna Dexter.
Now, back to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Back for a few more minutes. If you'd like to join us, 1-800-351-1212. We'll get to those calls in a minute, but I thought I'd go around the round table real quickly because we do have some very significant changes in the candidacies so far. On the Republican side, of course, you have Rick Perry that's dropped out, now Scott Walker that's dropped out. In a minute, I might get you a list of maybe some others you think should drop out. Then, more serious than ever, that maybe Joseph Biden will run on the Democratic side. But any comments about that? Most people were predicting that maybe the final three originally, before all this happened, would be maybe Jeb Bush and maybe Marco Rubio, and almost everybody put Scott Walker in the final three or the final five, and for him to drop out so early, there's some reasons for it. First of all, he really had a much larger campaign than many. Rather than wait for a campaign to catch fire, he spent a lot of money, so it's real easy to be burning through your campaign cash really quickly. But he finally just gave up and said, you know, I do have a responsibility as governor of Wisconsin, so I'm going back there, and I'm going to make available some of the financial resources I have and put them in Marco Rubio's hand. But what about this?
Well, one reason he burned through his campaign cash so quickly is because he basically employed the D.C. consultant class for his campaign, which they didn't do him any good this time. My respect for Scott Walker, I like him, and I think that the idea that he dropped out was smart on his part. He's going to have now an influence. His people will go to other campaigns. His ideas will be out there, and, you know, he's not going to be demonized. He quit while I think the getting was good. I think it was very just great, wise of him to drop out now, and some other candidates could definitely do well by following his example.
Yeah. Two governors out, though. We thought at least some governors would be in the final running, but
yeah, and the ones that are there, I mean, well, anyway, there are some there. I have said famously on Point of View that I think governors make the best
yes.
presidents, but, you know, it's not the only qualification. There's
right.
other qualifications, and we just may not get, as a conservative, especially the social conservative standard bearer, I don't know if that will end up being a governor. But, you know, seeing that, I think probably the people that benefit most from this and are getting some of his campaign people are Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz.
How about some people that need to get off the stage so we can put all the candidates that deserve an attention on one stage? What do you think, Debbie?
I have a list.
No.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's hear the list.
Of those who should get out, and really not because of personal dislike for them, but because they're getting no traction, they have no unique reason to be in the race, and that is Governor Pataki, Senator Graham, Governor Gilmore, Governor Kasich, and Governor Huckabee. And all those people, I will say, Kasich, I hear the argument that someone may really want him as a VP because he's Ohio and it's such an important swing state. And he is very popular in Ohio. I'm not sure why, but he really is. I don't care for him as a candidate particularly. I don't care for his Pearly Gates kind of, I don't know if you hear that Pearly Gates argument he makes, but I think that is disturbing. But the only one who's really low in the polls I kind of hope stays in is Bobby Jindal, a Louisiana governor. And I just think in his case, he brings a unique combination of strong Christian faith, clarity in his thinking on the social issues, strength about Islam, a successful record in Louisiana. I don't know of the downside of Bobby Jindal except for not gaining traction. But I think the players are going to end up being, it's going to be Trump, Carson, Fiorina, Rubio, Cruz, and Bush. It's going to be those six on the stage. And I think that, you know, that you can divide up how you want. To my sense of it is you have Fiorina and Bush kind of vying for the establishment role. Rubio somewhere in there. And then on Trump and Carson, I think, are looking to be the more the conservative choice. And Ted Cruz, who is a great combination of, you know, Christian faith and clarity in all the issues. So,
yeah, it's interesting you put Fiorina as an establishment with Bush because, you know, she's running as the outsider, and yet we're seeing more and more. I mean, she was really tied in with the National Senate Committee, and she did run for Senate, and there's just a lot of other reasons to say she is perhaps a little more, quote-unquote, establishment than she's portrayed herself to be. She's been a very, very talented person in communicating ideas.
She's brilliant in the debate. She stands out in every single one. She's outstanding. I'll say one more quick thing, if I may, about Donald Trump. My husband actually went to go see him in Dallas. We were not supporting him, but we went to see him at the rally. I will say what you end up feeling like around Donald Trump is that he is responding that kind of gut level feel in voters. I want to hear someone who says America's a good country. The American people are good people. We can be back on track. We can be on top. He makes people feel like America's good. Americans are good. And it's a response to the 6 years plus of listening to the left talk America down, describe America as racist and homophobic and intolerant and Islamophobic and blah, blah, blah. And he's just saying, no, we're good and we can be a success again. You could have asked anyone at that rally, what's his position on XYZ?
Yeah.
They wouldn't know and they wouldn't care. And I think there's a lesson there with the other candidates. People want to hear you get what America is and you love it. That's what they want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting as we end the show today and we're thinking about all the candidates and others speaking to this gathering of social conservatives back in Washington, D.C. at the Values Voters Summit. And we look at this and we started the show talking about how this is so interesting. And it's really good theater in a sense to see all these different people and what they bring to it. And then the resignation of the speaker. So a story is being told here. We can't tell you what the ending is. We don't even know what it is. But it's going to be interesting to watch, and we'll certainly continue to cover it here on Point of View.
You can imagine if 6 months ago I said, you know, I imagine by September that the leading candidates will be a successful businessman, a relatively successful businesswoman, and a neurophysiologist. You
amazing.
Go, you are smoking some of that funny weed right next to the road there because there's not a chance. And that's exactly where we find ourselves. And you have to go down a little further than to find two senators, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. So it is interesting because there are people that are starting to vet the business background of Carly Fiorina, the business background of Donald Trump and some other things. But we'll see whether it makes any difference. And the big question I think the top three need to answer right now is, who would you put in your cabinet? Since all three of you do not have political experience, who would be the people that would be making those decisions, since you obviously don't have as much political experience as you have business experience or medical experience?
Kirby, I think that's a very important question, and I do wish all the candidates would start to say, especially ones who've never had any role in government, who do you know who would come on your team? Are you bringing in people from the business world? Who are you going to have as your experts on whatever the subject is? It's very important that because they're signaling, I understand I don't know everything, that I need experts. You want to hear that they know they need that.
And they know how to pick the right people. You know, again, one person's been doing Celebrity Apprentice says I can pick them, but, you know, still got to figure this out. I want to know what your Secretary of Defense looks like and your Secretary of State looks like and your Treasury Secretary and some others. But anyway, we are out of time. Sorry I didn't get to some phone calls, but we'll have lots of opportunity next week. Let me just, before we run out of time, run through all the resources. First of all, of course, we want to encourage you to give to Point of View. We have a matching fund, and we would hate to leave any of those dollars on the table because we did not meet our match. So if you can help us out, especially as we go off the air, go to our website, pointofview.net, or respond to one of the emails I've sent to you. We have, of course, Penna's Viewpoints commentary on Chaplain Motter, just a really great piece, so make a point of printing it out and maybe hitting that share button, put it on your Facebook page, and tell people we're winning a lot of very important issues. And then, of course, we have an opportunity for you to fight to defund Planned Parenthood. All of it on the website, pointofview.net.
I was going to say, folks, if you ever haven't gone to layiskimmytalk.org, we had a major redo of the website. It's full now of talking points and major issues. So visit that website if you would.
I think you'll be talking about some of these issues this weekend, won't you?
Absolutely. This is my show prep right here on Friday.
Well, again, Penna, thank you so very much. We had a real fun on the anniversary show earlier this week. And Debbie, thank you for joining us. We will be back in it next week. And so I encourage you to visit the website, pointofview.net. And I encourage you to, if you can, support this ministry, because we certainly do need to hear from you. I want to thank Andrew, Catherine, and Chris for their help behind the scenes. Have a great weekend. We will see you back here on Monday.
Riddle time. What is often misunderstood and ticks down faster than a Texas student's homemade clock? A point of view matching challenge. Okay, that was a really bad attempt to get your attention. There are so many issues today where wisdom is needed. You need as many allies as you can get at a time like this, and I believe the nation needs point of view. We have a friend who thinks so too. He believes it so much, he has put his money where his worldview is, and he is challenging you to do the same thing. For every gift you give, this friend will give an equal amount up to $50,000. Look, some have financial backhoes which dig with zeros on the end. If that's you, fire it up and dig. Many of us dig with teaspoons or fingernails. Bottom line, we need you to dig and give. We have just a few days left. Double your impact when you give generously. 1-800-347-5151 or online at pointofview.net. That's 800-347-5151 and pointofview.net. Thank you.
Point of View is produced by Point of View Ministries.